Okay, welcome, Andrew, to RCR 360. It's so good to have you here.
Thanks, Alistair. Great to be here.
Okay, I want to talk today with you about the global censorship industrial complex. And I see you as somebody who can talk quite authoritatively about that because you were part of Matt Taibbi's Twitter files, or Elon Musk's Twitter files, I should say, working with Matt Taibbi. Can you tell me a little bit about that work that you did, just to sort of set us up in this conversation?
Sure. So when people probably, well, a lot of people would know the story that when Elon Musk bought Twitter, he essentially invited a number of journalists into the company to look through, well, somewhat selectively, but the searches that the journalists ran or requested to look through those files and see what they could discover in terms of coordinated attempts to censor and suppress information. The first journalist that he allowed in was Matt Taibbi, and I worked with Matt for about 4 months in kind of the second half of the Twitter files, because he was finding a lot of NGOs, a lot of kind of private liberal philanthropic organizations, a lot of academic institutions, etc., that were involved in kind of content flagging and coordinating with Twitter to suppress information. He didn't know what that network of organizations was. What that network was kind of all these NGOs, academics in the kind of liberal progressive vein, which is where I had spent probably almost 2 decades. So I actually knew a lot of the NGOs that he was like finding. In some cases, I partnered with them on other types of projects, not on the information suppression projects. And I'd been kind of seeing this pattern in that space, which had been a space where of kind of promoting digital free expression, so online free speech, and starting around 2015, accelerating further into 17, 18, etc., had become, well, a lot of those groups had kind of flipped, or new ones had emerged to actually kind of promote countering disinformation, which oftentimes seemed to amount to suppressing valid and certainly often mostly legal speech. So I was like, I know a lot about those groups. I can help you. And so we basically worked together and through that kind of mapped what became known as the censorship industrial complex, which is basically a network of nonprofits, of academics, of big tech, of private philanthropy, of media organizations, of government bodies, private companies. There's a whole bunch of different things that are going on there, and there are different nodes that are more important than others that get more money. There are people who give out hundreds of millions of dollars, and there are other philanthropies that give out tens of millions. So it's that's why I kind of emphasize the web, or the complex part of it, because it's there are big actors in there that need to kind of focus on, but it's also the reason that it's been quite successful is that in many ways, it's mobilized people voluntarily to kind of take up this battle of, we're going to combat the bad information that's on the internet and make the world a better place. And there's only a minority of people who I think are actually acting very cynically, who are like, actually, this is a project to sideline our political enemies and advance our particular interests.
So this is, you describe it as a web. Who's in this web? Are we talking about tech companies? We're talking about US government or government agencies around the world?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So you're talking about, on the US government side, you're talking about, the State Department, the Department of Defense gives a lot of money. People probably would have been hearing a lot about USAID. Lately, which certainly is one government department handing out money, but there are many more. The National Science Foundation, Health and Human Services, National Institutes of Health. There are dozens of government agencies who basically put money into this enterprise. So some of the work that my nonprofit, LibreNet, has been doing lately has been to kind of map all of the publicly known funding that the US government has handed out since 2016 for what could reasonably be considered censorship or content moderation or kind of influencing type work. So we've kind of looked through, you know, more than 1,000 grants, and you know, there's definitely at least 500 of those, I would say, very problematic. So there's, because you can get a lot, most of this information is publicly available. You can get it online. So a lot of the conversation in the last few weeks has been, oh my God, we discovered this, but actually most of that information has been publicly known. Someone just had to go and look for it online.
A lot of what you're talking about, when you're talking about HHS, for instance, Department of Defense, and all of those different agencies, on that level, it sounds to me like we're not actually talking about journalism, we're talking about PR.
Yeah, I think in many cases it is. It is PR. And it's also kind of US soft power. You know, it's like, let's support this journalism outlet in Moldova or Albania or Mozambique or Zimbabwe, et cetera, et cetera. And sometimes it's like you look at the grant and you go, you know, I've been going through and basically rating them of like, you know, horrible to meh, basically to, you know, not really important. You know, and you'll see when it's like $50,000 to Zimbabwe media literacy organization to promote, you know, better understanding of investigative journalism or something. You kind of go, oh, that doesn't sound evil. They're not doing it because out of goodness of their heart. It's essentially kind of trying to build a kind of cadre of kind of friendly journalists or and media. So in that sense, it's PR. And then they're the ones who are like, you know, money for, you know, entity in Moldova to flag, you know, Russian disinformation to tech company, which is very deliberately trying to censor, say, dissidents in Moldova.
But that's how it crosses over from public relations for these big government agencies into journalism. And that's how journalism gets co-opted into it.
Yeah, so it gets co-opted. And I think that's the thing. It can't always just be cartoonish and two-dimensional in the way that it works. You're kind of building this kind of clientelism. So through all this money, you're building a kind of set of journalists who are friendly to the US and are going to basically give the US perspective when they write. I mean, and so it's just kind of, it's actually just kind of what you would do. Any government that was trying to have a lot of kind of influence over the world outside of its borders would do this kind of thing. And I'm sure if the Chinese or the Russians could get good at this kind of stuff, then they would definitely also do it. It just happens that the US is really good. So that's why a lot of people in the kind of global NGO space, and so maybe just to step back, what I did previously was I ran a kind of digital rights or digital free expression NGO that worked in Southeast Asia. So, you know, we were working with activists in Myanmar who were campaigning for free expression, where the military was kind of trying to shut it down. So, you know, and there was money around that. We never directly took money from the US government, but there were certainly organizations around that did. And, you know, sometimes we would partner with them on a workshop to say how to be more secure online for journalists type thing. And we didn't think of that as being particularly nefarious, or we thought of as well, there's these people with these interests, and then there's the kind of Burmese military. Do we do nothing, or do we kind of partner here and kind of do this workshop, knowing that there's, you know, that we know those other people have some other interests as well? So sometimes we did the workshop.
See, that's really interesting, because what you're talking about there is some good to be done there, but also that's the foundations of, say, what we saw in the COVID era, or when they started talking about doing workshops on how to spot misinformation and so on. And that's when journalists started to sort of slip into this area, this more gray area where they are being co-opted.
Well, no, and totally. And so I think, because I was in that space for quite a long time, and so I never really saw a strong attempt. I never really saw people particularly biting their tongues because it was going to cost them money until COVID, right? So, and then what happened during COVID, because I was still running my nonprofit, was that all of that, those digital free expression people just went quiet about COVID. And they criticized a little bit the contact tracing apps and the kind of privacy implications of those at the start. But after 6 months, everyone basically, you know, whilst, you know, couldn't talk about, you know, Facebook had a policy, you cannot talk about the lab leak hypothesis on our platform. All this digital censorship started happening, vaccine passports, which should have been for people talking about digital privacy and expression, like a major, massive topic to talk about, and no one talked about it. And the reason is exactly what you were saying, is that it was kind of a slow burn that I could kind of see a little bit going on, but I didn't, just after 15 or more years, I never actually saw them kind of use that power. And then during COVID, they did. And they went, actually, we're not for digital free expression anymore. Actually, we're for countering disinformation, and we have to like tell anyone who's got any questions about COVID to be quiet. And you would have thought at least there would have been a few people going, hey, you know, we've just gone from, we're never at war with Oceania, you know, we've always been at war with Eurasia. And at least, you know, some amount of people will put their hand up and go, this is off, something's wrong. But in my field, again, the field dedicated to digital free expression, working with people in Myanmar, in the Philippines, Indonesia, people working in repressive regimes all around the world, almost everyone went zip.
Well, and at that point, you know, the money, if you don't, the money dries up, right?
Yeah, the money does dry up. And so I understand why like a certain percentage of people would just stay zip. But what was incredible was just that 99% or more of people stayed zip. I mean, to toot my horn, I was one of the people who didn't. You know, and it's taken a very long time to find the people who also didn't, because they're out there, but everyone got kind of scattered and divided. So all these people were, if they had done their job, then actually I think a lot of what the repression you'd seen in COVID wouldn't have happened. But yes, it's precisely because this kind of NGO clientelism that people basically decided, well, do I want my job or my principles? And they decided to keep their job.
Okay, talking about COVID and going back to the Twitter files discussion at the beginning of our discussion, one of the things that you looked at was the virality project. And I believe this is an example of the US government pouring money into censorship in a really obvious way. Can you tell us about what the virality project was and what did you discover about it?
So essentially the virality project's remit, as it described it, was to combat anti-vaccine misinformation. In reality, it basically attempted to censor a whole range of different things about COVID and criticism of the kind of government response to it. So the antecedent to the Virality Project was actually something called the Election Integrity Partnership that was explicitly set up by the Department of Homeland Security. So there's a email that goes to a guy at the Atlantic Council called Graham Brookie, who runs something called the Digital Forensics Research Lab, that he emails a number of other people saying, we've just been contacted by the Department of Homeland Security /CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, to set up an election integrity partnership. And basically that partnership, that looks at the election, and I kind of won't specifically go into everything they did there, but there's a lot of censorship that they essentially flagged around what they considered election misinformation. And then directly after the 2020 election, they converted themselves into the Virality Project, added three more partners, two from New York University and another one called the National Congress for Citizenship, I believe it's called, to expand it a little bit. But they're quite explicit in emails to Twitter that were found in the Twitter files, that, you know, this is a continuation of this Election Integrity Partnership, which, as we said at the beginning, was initiated by the Department of Homeland Security, which is essentially an intelligence and security agency of the government. So it's essentially acting as a proxy. It's a government. But what the Virality Project does is it goes about flagging what it considers COVID or anti-vaccine misinformation that flags a whole bunch of different things. Amongst the things it flags are one is a girl called, I'll put a post about a girl called Mehdi Degari, who participated, or parents made her participate in a Pfizer trial for the childhood version of the COVID vaccine, and who got severely injured and had multiple doctor certificates saying the cause of her injuries was the Pfizer vaccine. And there were stories about this. The Virality Project flagged those stories online, including stories by mainstream media, as misinformation to Twitter and others, and says, you should take this, this, well, they don't actually ever say, actually, you should take this down, but they kind of basically infer it through their communications. And they say in her case that, this stuff is misinformation because the timing is wrong, because it doesn't line up with the dates of the Moderna trial. So she's in the Pfizer trial, and all the information that they have actually logged is about the Pfizer trial, all the screenshots. But then they basically say can't be true because she's in the Moderna trial, which she was never in. So they're either incompetent or something worse in terms of how they're doing this. One of the other examples would be the suspension and censorship of Martin Kulldorff. Martin Kulldorff was measures. He was a professor of epidemiology at Harvard. He was even on a CDC vaccine safety committee related to the COVID vaccines. So this guy's, has expertise. He wrote a tweet essentially saying that if you had had COVID, or if you were a child, you didn't need to get the vaccine. That was his opinion as a Harvard epidemiologist specializing in vaccines. Virality Project flagged his tweet as misinformation, and it was labeled, and then it was taken down, and then he was suspended from Twitter. So
Who are the people working in these organizations like the Virality Project? I mean, to me, that seems like a special kind of, I'm going to use this word not lightly, a special kind of evil that you can take true information and tell everybody it's not true. Who are these people that are working in these organizations?
well, they seem like there were a lot of students actually that were mobilized at one point. I don't know if this is for the Election Integrity Partnership or for the Virality Project. It might have been less for the Virality Project, but at one point they claimed to have had 125 people working on this. And also, it's not necessarily that they're saying that it's actually worse than saying that it's not true. It's actually saying that it's not even debatable, kind of thing. Because I don't think information has to be true. I think most of the times we get things wrong. I've probably got some, at least two things wrong, five things wrong more since I've spoken here with you now. The point is that you have a dialogue and a discussion, and you kind of try to get a little bit closer each time to the truth. So they were basically using CDC guidance and saying if it goes against the government, it's misinformation. And that was essentially the kind of way they were going about doing this. But yeah, oftentimes they had no expertise. They weren't. So in this consortium of those seven groups that I listed off, not a single one of them is like a public health institution that would actually be able to tell you an input and say, oh, yes, no, yes, that's medically correct, or that's a medical debate, or no, that's flat out false. They're all basically digital organizations. And the way they're making a decision whether or not something is true and false is whether or not a government agency, one that turned out to be incredibly fallible, and in this case, the CDC, says it's true or not. So it's basically the government is always right, and we're here to make sure it is so.
So when we talk about this, you mentioned early on in this conversation about a web. Is this a web which is coordinated, which is organized all together? I'm thinking of other organizations as part of this too, like the State Department's Global Engagement Center is another one. There's also the Internews Network, which has come up in discussions about censorship in the past couple of weeks. How is this all connected together? Is it a deliberate connection, or is it just connections of convenience for all these different groups?
I mean, I think it's a lot of that is kind of speculation. I think there are more important nodes. So there are agencies or that give out more money than others, like the Global Engagement Center, the state, which is under the State Department, like National Science Foundation, like HHS, like USAID, etc. So there are actors that are more important. There are particular people who are more important, of course, than others who are kind of making the funding, the decisions that this is going to be policy and this is what we're going to do. I mean, one of the things we know is that there was definitely a lot of White House pressure on Twitter and Facebook and other social media to censor content as well. So this stuff goes, you know, went right to the top of the government as well. Is there a kind of grand poobah person? There probably would be various candidates like Anthony Blinken or others, but I don't know that anyone's come up with enough evidence to say there's kind of one single entity. And I think in some ways it's not necessarily a helpful way to think about it anyway, because there's just so much, like the scandal is that there's just so many agencies, so much private philanthropy, so much NGO and academic work that goes into this. It is a kind of massive kind of cultural phenomena. And that's the scandal, is how did you convince so many people to essentially go along with this censorship work and think that they were doing something good? Like, that for me is a scandal, not here's a secret bunker where, you know, the kind of chief censor is hiding.
And a lot of the time people want to be able to blame one person. They want to be able to blame Bill Gates or Anthony Fauci or Joe Biden or someone, anybody. And then on the reverse of that, they also want to see a savior in one person, i.e. Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And it isn't that case.
No, I think they were kind of wired in a way to kind of think about the world in that way. And so then people will step in and be like, you know, I'm the Messiah. I'm the Messiah. And people go, he's the Messiah, and they all, you know, chase after him, and he's the one. So we just need to watch Life of Brian, and then, you know, we'll understand.
One of the things that we see here in New Zealand, if we could bring the conversation to our little part of the world, is our former Prime Minister, who took us through the COVID era. She derived a lot of her power during that time from the censorship industrial complex or the censorship apparatus. She's now traveling the world on the taxpayers' money as the head of what they call the Christchurch Call. And this she's basically calling for censorship. There was a famous speech she made to the UN talking about how words are weapons and so on. The fight here is over freedom of speech, isn't it? That's where it all comes down to. How important is this fight?
Well, I would actually go back to your first comment, is that actually New Zealand is very important in this thing because of exactly what you said with the Christchurch Call, that was a turning point, I think, where the kind of counterterrorism apparatus shifted quite significantly to countering violent extremism. And that was essentially in a shift from kind of external enemies. Obviously, the counterterrorism was also looking internally, but not at kind of vast swathes of the population. But the countering violent extremism basically said, oh, bad people could be anywhere, right? Because they look like the majority of our, or one half of the majority of the population in our societies, right? And so we need to basically go and monitor and do more surveillance more broadly and generally, and monitoring and censorship of hateful speech. And that, I think at the end of the day, what this is a way for one group of people who are at the top of the pile or near the top of the pile, depending on which society, you're in, basically being able to like manage control the kind of frames of reference of the debate, actually. And I'll give you an example of just how far that goes in another context with the UK. The chief of staff to Keir Starmer, now a man by the name of Morgan McSweeney, was the founder of one of the leading so-called anti-hate or anti-disinformation organizations called the Center for Countering Digital Hate. So, and these were people who were trying to get RFK Jr. kicked off the internet during COVID. They had huge levels of access. They coordinated a letter that we found in the Twitter files from 12 Democratic governors, basically calling for this disinformation dozen, as they called them, to be taken off the internet. They're very responsible for bringing down Jeremy Corbyn in the UK as well. And you know, the guy who basically founded and ran that operation is now the chief of staff to the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. So this is not a kind of sideshow, all this stuff to political power. It essentially became like one of the main strategies to achieving power itself. And then one thing I would also add is that I think people sometimes see this as a kind of this is progressives or the left kind of censoring people on the right, which I don't think is correct. I think what it is actually much more people in the center, this kind of liberal center, kind of corporate Democrats type thing, trying to get rid of their political enemies, either on the left or the right. And so that includes kind of a Bernie Sanders and a Jeremy Corbyn on one side, and it also includes a Trump and others on the other.